The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by my Paranormal Plus Club Halloween sale. Access to 1,200 podcasts, and I'm telling you, there's tons of exclusive podcasts over there. The archives of the Paranormal Podcast and Campfire. Check it out at jimherold.net and get $25 off a yearly membership by using the coupon code HALLOWEEN16 during our Halloween sale. It's all at jimherold.net.
This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harold.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I'm Jim Harold and so glad to be with you once again. And boy, do we have a great show for you today. Another one of these doubleheaders, kind of the direction we're going with the show. We're going to start off talking about Houdini and the Witch of Lime Street. David Jayer is joining us and it's a smash book. And I think you'll find it very interesting. Always been fascinated about the spiritualism movement and Houdini. And David goes into that in great depth. It's going to be very, very interesting. Then we're only getting started because Joe Citrone and Steve Pate will join us to talk about their hit TV series, Haunted Case Files. So with no further ado, let's get to it. It is the Paranormal Podcast. Growing up, I think I've often mentioned, obviously, I'm was interested in the paranormal, but I was also interested in magic. Never took off because I have no capability in the area of sleight of hand whatsoever. I'm all thumbs. But one of the people that I was immediately attracted to was Houdini. And he is a big part of the book that we're going to talk about today. David Jayer is on the line. He is the author of the new book, The Witch of Lime Street, Seance, Seduction, and Houdini in the Spirit World. So not only was he a magician, a movie maker, a movie star, he was also one of the great debunkers. And we're going to talk to David about The Witch of Lime Street just out. David, welcome to the program today.
Thanks, Jim. Great to be here.
So let's talk about the time frame. I think it's important when you talk about this particular book to kind of get the zeitgeist of the times. Where were we spiritually at the time that this book is set?
Well, this book is set right after World War One, and I don't think the Western world had ever experienced such devastation in terms of the number of dead from that war and from the subsequent influenza epidemic, which also took a disproportionate amount of young people. You know, by some estimates, as many as 100 million people died as the result of the war and as the result of the epidemic. So you had this collective yearning to want to know if the souls of all these dead people survived and if they could be reached. And because of that, there is the revival of this religious movement called spiritualism, which is a religion with really only one tenet, and that is the belief that, you know, that the souls of the dead survive and they can be reached, and only one ritual, and that ritual is the seance. So spiritualism, after World War One, was considered this rising religion. You know, there was this feeling among some people that it was going to supplant the, you know, traditional Western religions and become mainstream, and, you know, that had to do partially with the fact that you had some very prominent Englishmen like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who was sort of the de facto leader of the spiritualist movement. You know, essentially Conan Doyle had lost every male member of his family who served during the war, including his son, and he believed he was in touch with their spirits through the seance. Sir Oliver Lodge, who was one of the most well-known scientists in England, had also lost his son, and he believed he was in touch with the spirit of his son. He wrote a book called Raymond, which his son's name was Raymond, and he believed he was contacting him through the seance. They say that Raymond was more popular than the Bible in the trenches during World War One. So you had this, you know, this real kind of occult renaissance after World War One, and, you know, this fascination with spiritualism, this fascination with the seance that spreads to America when Conan Doyle and Sir Oliver Lodge come to America in the early 1920s. America had not experienced the same sort of loss as Europe had. I mean, France, Germany, England had all lost a generation, but we were still hit pretty hard by the epidemic. So there was this death consciousness in America as well at that time.
Now, the other main player, or another main player in this book, is someone who I think has been kind of lost to the mists of time until now, was Marjorie.
Right. Yeah. You know, Marjorie is a fascinating figure, and she's really very reflective of the Jazz Age. I mean, she had this ebullience. You know, you think of spirit mediums and psychics as being these kind of delicate, fragile, ethereal creatures. And Marjorie wasn't like that at all. I mean, you know, Marjorie was sort of a flapper, but she was also a society wife. I mean, she was a fast liver. You know, she drove her car really fast, and she liked to dance and listen to music and smoke and swear. So she wasn't traditionally what you consider a psychic medium to be like. And she came to prominence. So Sir Arthur Conan Doyle comes to America, and now there is this spiritualist revival in America too. You know, Conan Doyle was one of the great speakers of his time, and he would tour America along with Sir Arthur Lodge, the English scientist I mentioned. And so, you know, the spirit craze spreads to America. But concurrent with that was this fascination with contests. I mean, the early 1920s was also a time when the Miss America contest became popular. There were all these aviation contests. There were these dance marathon contests. So Sir Arthur Conan Doyle challenges a very important magazine in those days, the Scientific American magazine. Scientific American magazine was not just a magazine. It was an investigative agency in those days, almost like today's 60 Minutes. And, you know, there's this real interest in psychic mediumship, and Scientific American was reporting on psychics and mediums in practically every issue in the early 1920s, which shows, you know, how there's this merging between science and occult phenomena. And so Arthur Conan Doyle challenges the magazine, and he says to them, look, you know, you're reporting on psychic phenomena, but you're not taking a stand. You know, you're not telling the public whether or not there really is any legitimacy to spiritualism and spirit communication and psychic effects. So the Scientific American responds through its editor, Malcolm Bird, in a way which really shocked Conan Doyle, because they said, okay, we're going to conduct an investigation, but we're going to do it in the guise of a contest. We're going to get together some of the top scientists in America, and we're going to put up a large cash prize to any psychic medium who can manifest phenomena before this committee of scientists, which passes their scrutiny, which they declare is genuine spirit communication or genuine psychic effect. So this contest goes on for a couple of years, and every single contestant is declared a charlatan. Nobody can pass the scrutiny of these scientists. And then this young, beautiful Boston society medium comes along, and that's Marjorie. And she stumps all the scientists. She's put on the front page of the New York Times. She's essentially declared the first scientifically verified medium in history. But the last judge whose scrutiny she had to pass was the magician Houdini's. He was the world's expert on psychic fraud, and he was called in when the scientists were stumped. And there begins one of the great rivalries in American history when Houdini shows up in Boston to test the psychic medium Marjorie.
Didn't Houdini have kind of a visceral reaction to frauds in the spiritual arena? And wasn't there a very personal reason for that?
Absolutely. One of the reasons Houdini knew all the tricks of psychic mediums is because Houdini at one time was a fraud medium. Before he became famous as a magician in the 1890s during the Gilded Age, he had to make a living. And, you know, there was also real interest in spiritualism then and interest in seances then, not to the degree of the 1920s. But so Houdini had this false spiritualist act that was based on an act that the Davenport magicians had developed, where he would be tied up during a seance, and all these instruments would be placed out of his reach, and they would spontaneously begin to play and float around the room, supposedly at the behest of the spirits. He would also do these cold readings where he would conduct seances, and, you know, he would channel information from the dead, and people believed it. For the first time in his life, he started to make money. But, you know, Houdini, being the son of a rabbi, also felt a tremendous amount of guilt. He felt like he was defrauding the public because this was trickery, and they believed it to be genuine. And so, you know, he felt like he was sort of developing this reputation as being this mystic, you know, this great spirit medium, which he wasn't. So he stopped doing that act. Then later in life, right before World War I began, you know, now Houdini is a famous magician, and his mother dies. And Houdini had this incredibly passionate relationship with his mother. E.L. Doctorow referred to him as the last of the great mother lovers, because this was right before Freud became popular in America. And, you know, you can write romantic letters to your mother in those days, and nobody thought anything of it. You know, he was just, I mean, his marriage really was second fiddle to his relationship with his mother. And when his mother died in 1913, he was just devastated. So he began to see psychic mediums. You know, he wanted to, you know, have some sort of reunion with her. He wanted to contact her spirit. And, you know, this was right before World War I. So he identified with all these people who had lost their loved ones during the war, because he lost his mother during that time period. And he began to feel exploited. He thought these psychics and mediums were exploiting him, just as they were exploiting the post-war bereaved, that they were all frauds, and that there was this huge post-war racket. So ultimately, he considered it his role to go after all these phony psychics, because he feels like they're the worst kind of criminals, they're the worst kind of predators, because they are preying on the bereaved. And so he would infiltrate seances, disguised as an old man who'd lost his son. And when he caught the medium cheating, he would pull out a flashlight, and he would shine it on them if they were, you know, faking the phenomena that the spirits were supposed to be causing. And so he was developing a reputation as this great psychic debunker. And that's what he wanted. Houdini said again and again that he didn't want to go down in history as just a great magician. He wanted to do something socially meaningful. And he considered this his great role. And so, of course, now you have, you know, the greatest magician in the world and this fierce psychic debunker going up against this great psychic cope, Marjorie. And, you know, Marjorie was a medium who never took money for her seances. She wasn't a professional. And she was, you know, an upper-class society woman. So nobody thought she would have any motivation to cheat or defraud anybody. So, you know, Houdini is really interesting social conflict which is going on, because Houdini is this immigrant Jew who built himself up from nothing. And, you know, he's taking on the society medium in Boston. And I wouldn't say that Marjorie had, I mean, you know, she was a very good-natured person. But if Houdini had issues with her religion, then this woman's husband, who was a very prominent Boston surgeon, definitely had issues with Houdini's religion, because he did not like Jews. And, you know, that wasn't unusual in Beacon Hill society in those days.
It's a fascinating discussion. We're going to be back with David Jayer on The Witch of Lime Street on the Paranormal Podcast right after this. What a great time of the year to have a Paranormal Plus Club sale. Now, if you listen to this show and you're not familiar with the Paranormal Plus Club, maybe you are new, you can go over to jimherold.net and you can listen to shows older than 90 days for the Paranormal Podcast, for my Campfire Podcast. So you have shows going all the way back to 2005. And then you get tons of exclusive podcasts that have never been on the free feed. In fact, if you add all the different podcasts together, it turns out to be something like over 1,200 shows. And many of them, again, hundreds of them, have never been on the free feed. Now, what do we cover over there in addition to the Paranormal Podcast and Campfire? A little bit of everything. We've got a new show called The Cryptid Report that we just launched over there exclusively to the Plus Club. We've got UFO Encounters. We've got Ghost Insight, where we talk to ghost hunters and spooky folk like that. We've got The Conspiracy Corner, where we talk about things like the JFK assassination and weird conspiracy theories. And then we've also got Crime Scene, where we talk to people about true crime, authors and experts about cases in the past. Many times, I don't think many of the free listeners know that all of this exists, and you can get it over at jimherold.net. That's jimherold.net. And best of all, we have a Halloween sale. If you want to join at the yearly membership level, you could get $25 off a year. It turns out to be pennies a day. And you get access to all of this great treasure trove that you can listen to whenever you want, wherever you want. Plus, we have a bunch of archived webinars over there with video where we've had great speakers come on and talk about things like communicating with the dead and tarot and UFOs, and the list goes on and on. But if you're not a member, you can't check out any of that great stuff. So do me a favor, go over to jimherold.net. That's jimherold.net and check it out. I think you really will enjoy it. It is very cool. We have many happy members, some people who have been a member since 2011 when we first launched it. So I hope you'll check it out. The Halloween sale, $25 off a yearly membership. To get the savings, use the coupon code Halloween16 at checkout. That's Halloween16 at checkout. And be sure to double check that total. We want to make sure that you get the deal. So that's Halloween16 is the promo code. Thank you so much, and check out the Paranormal Plus Club. We're back on the Paranormal Podcast. The book today is The Witch of Lime Street, Seance Seduction, and Houdini in the Spirit World. David Jayer is our guest and the author of said book, and we're talking a lot about the rivalry between the famous magician Harry Houdini and the spiritualist and psychic Marjorie. How big was Marjorie? I mean, you know, you kind of think about people that go by one name. You think of later on Elvis or Madonna and something like somebody is going by one name. You get the sense that they're pretty well known. How big was she? I mean, we all know Houdini pretty much, but not so much Marjorie. How prominent was she at this time?
Well, Marjorie became huge, and that was a stage name. Her middle name was Marguerite. So when she entered the Scientific American contest, which is sometimes called the psychic contest, Malcolm Bird, who was the editor of Scientific American, wanted to protect her privacy because, again, you know, she was a society woman. She, being a psychic medium, was not considered the most reputable thing in the world. So they wanted to protect her anonymity. So they called her Marjorie, with, you know, derivation of her middle name, Marguerite, which is very catchy. And, you know, here's this woman who sort of, I mean, she's really, again, she's so reflective of the jazz age. She shows up out of nowhere, and she has this incredible infectious charm and this incredible spirit. And so, she, as I mentioned, she's put on the front page of the New York Times and many other newspapers, and she essentially becomes the avatar of the spiritualist movement. She becomes the great psychic hope. I mean, there were millions of spiritualists at that time. And she becomes the most famous one. She had the glamour almost of a movie star because she was young and beautiful, and she was so charismatic. And there was this mystery about her because at first nobody knew her real identity. Her name was Mina Crandon, and she was married to one of the most prominent surgeons in Boston. But there was this aura of mystery around her because at first nobody knew her real identity. Now later on, the reporters found out her true identity. But in a sense, she's also a creation of the press because, you know, the press recognizes that anything having to do with occultism and spiritualism is really fodder for the public right now. I mean, there's this spiritualist craze, this interest in the Ouija, this interest in seances. So they really build her up. And remember, this was a time period where Houdini, I mean, is probably the most famous American in the world. In between a time when Teddy Roosevelt dies in 1919 and Lindbergh flies across the Atlantic in 1927, you can make an argument that Houdini is the most famous American in the world. But at the same time, you know, he's not able to do all the more acrobatic escapes he could do as a younger man. And he's looking to keep himself relevant and to keep himself in prominence, you know, so far as spiritualism and being the expert on psychic fraud. So in a sense, he also creates the fame around Marjorie because he wants to take down somebody who he considers, you know, the greatest fraud in history. So in a way, he's also building her up. He's also, in a sense, trying to witchify her. I mean, she's called the Witch of Lime Street, and she liked to think, you know, that she was a good witch, that she was helping people get in touch with the spirits of their loved ones who had passed on. Houdini, on the other hand, recognized that there was still a real stigma to witchcraft in these days. You know, just before the war, a woman was burned at the stake in Ireland who was accused of being a witch, and America being a predominantly Christian country, there is an animus against witchcraft in the Bible, and spirit mediumship is equated with witchcraft. So he tries to convince the American public that she's practicing black magic. You know, what are the things that you traditionally accuse a witch of during a witch trial? Well, one of the things is having this kind of salacious sexuality and seducing men. And Houdini accused Marjorie of sleeping with a number of the judges who declared her genuine during a Scientific American contest. He tries to convince the public that she is this mythic seductress, you know, almost like Circe, you know, the witch who seduces all of Odysseus's men and turns them to swine. And so, you know, he considers her, you know, this mythic seductress, and he tries to convince the public of that. Another thing you accuse witches of is voodoo. And Houdini tells the newspapers that she has created this Houdini effigy, and she's sticking pins and needles in it, and she's cast this spell on him and this curse on him, and has said he's going to be dead within a year. The third thing you traditionally accuse a witch of during a witch trial is some sort of mischief with children. And Houdini and Boston Herald reporters are exploring the fact that, investigating the fact that this woman and her husband are trying to adopt a male child, and they're, for some reason, they want to adopt an orphaned English child. So they're bringing these orphans over from England to see if they're suitable for adoption. And Houdini and these Boston Herald reporters are wondering if these kids are making it back to England, because they're finding no record of it. So there is this suspicion that they're up to some sort of mischief with these children. And again, that's what you accuse witches of it during a witch trial. There's always some sort of mischief and abduction having to do with kids. So Houdini is consciously trying to witchify Marjorie before the American public to turn the public against her and make it seem as though she's practicing this dark art. You know, that is, Houdini was fascinated with witchcraft during this period. He's writing a book on witchcraft. You know, in the last months of his life, that was sort of an obsession for him. He considered himself the person who was going to rid America of this dark cult spiritualism, which he associates with witchcraft.
Do you believe that Marjorie believed that she was really channeling something?
I think Marjorie definitely believed it, because by the end of her life, you know, after all her fame had waned and she was alone, she was still doing this. You know, sort of the image I have of her is channeling the spirit of her dead brother, Walter. When mediums go into trance and conduct seances, they often take on the spirit control of somebody dead who was close to them. In her case, it was Walter, who her brother with whom she was very close, who died during the war. And, you know, during the end of her life, she was still channeling Walter, but just only for herself. You know, through automatic writing, she would try to channel his spirit. So, yes, I do think she believed that what she was doing was authentic. And, you know, that's one of the things that also convinced other people that what she was doing was authentic, because they said that the character of Walter, when he would appear during seances, was so vivid. I mean, his voice would come from all parts of the room, and his personality was so vivid and so different from Marjorie's in every way. You know, Marjorie was the society medium, as we keep mentioning. So her, what she could say and do in public was sort of circumscribed. I mean, this was a time when women were not even allowed to sit on juries in Massachusetts. She wasn't, you know, woman at that class. We're not supposed to smoke or swear. But Walter, her spirit control, was a very tempestuous, very crude figure at times, and very pugnacious. So in a sense, it's Houdini versus this potent spirit, Walter, during seances. Because when Marjorie went into trance, you know, one of the things that was so incredible about what she was able to do were these physical effects. You know, she was a physical medium. So she was not known so much for bringing messages from the dead. What she would do was she would manifest this incredible poltergeist-like phenomena. Tables would rise to unprecedented heights. They say anything that wasn't tied down during her seances was liable to take flight. You know, a lamp would float across the room. People would be buffeted by this cold breeze that would appear from nowhere. These spirit lights would zip across the room. And in those days, mediums were put in spirit cabinets because they were said to manifest ectoplasm. But an ectoplasm exudes from the orifices in a woman's body. So she needs privacy to form her ectoplasm. So she's put in a spirit cabinet during seances, which is usually a wooden frame cabinet with a cloth front. Her arms and legs would extend from the cabinet so that the scientist, in Marjorie's case, could hold her arms and legs to make sure that, you know, she wasn't sneaking around the room causing any of this phenomena. And she would be put in a cabinet, and this cabinet would spontaneously just burst apart, supposedly, because Walter, would cause it to happen. And the scientists would also, they had these more scientific tests. They would take a bell, what they called a bell box, and put it out of her reach. And they would say to Walter, okay, Walter, you know, use your power to invisibly cause this bell box to ring, and the bell box would spontaneously start ringing. So these were the kinds of things that she had to do, and these were the kinds of things Houdini had to discredit.
And for his part, obviously it sounds like Houdini thought she was a complete and utter fraud.
Yeah, Houdini believed she was a fraud. Houdini, you know, but it's, you know, it's really interesting. Houdini was predisposed to believe she was a fraud because Houdini by this time thought all psychic mediums were fraud. But even Houdini said he couldn't explain everything she was able to do. Houdini would go before the public and he would give these really, really popular demonstrations where he would replicate Marjorie's phenomena and he would show how he was able to do it. But Houdini is a great athlete. You know, he's this the greatest escape artist in the world.
One of
the
contortionist.
Exactly. How was a society wife from Boston able to do these things that only a great magician should have been able to pull off? So in a lot of ways, if you believe Marjorie was a fraud, then the story becomes even more interesting and more mysterious because even Houdini could not explain how she was able to do all of these things. You know, he could replicate some of her phenomena, but other times, you know, he was stumped. He really could not explain what she was able to do.
Was this the kind of thing I could imagine maybe newsboys on the corner, like yelling out extra, extra and those kind of things. Was that the kind of thing we see in the movies? Because you got to think at this era, you know, radio is not really a force. Obviously television's not around, let alone the internet, you know, pretty much the mass communication were newspapers. Was this kind of played out in the newspapers?
Oh, absolutely. The newspapers had so much influence in those days for the reasons that you've just talked about. This was the singular media in those days. And, you know, New York had four or five times more major newspapers at that time than we have today. And all the newspapers were reporting on Marjorie. And once they found out her identity, reporters would camp on her doorstep. The press was fascinated with her. And, you know, Houdini knew how to use the press. And as we talked about earlier, he really, in some ways, he wanted to build her up because it made their rivalry more newsworthy. And if he was going to discredit her, you know, it made him more heroic. So, you know, in a sense, Marjorie and Houdini fed off of each other because they were both, in a sense, each individual's popularity was enhanced through this rivalry. Walter Marjorie Spirit Control once remarked that when Houdini died, spiritualism, in a sense, it sounds odd to say, was going to be losing one of its great advocates, because even though he thought spiritualism was a lot of nonsense and he was discrediting all these mediums, he was keeping spiritualism topical by attracting so much popular interest to it and so much press interest to it. And, you know, Walter is absolutely right. After Houdini dies in 1926, I mean, that's almost exactly when spiritualism really starts to wane in terms of popularity in America.
Now, for Marjorie's part, she it seems like Houdini was kind of combative in this whole rivalry. Was Marjorie equally combative, or was she kind of like, poor me, you know, why are you picking on me, Houdini? You're Houdini. I mean, what was her mindset in this? And how did she fight back? I mean, it's a different time. So women would be at a natural disadvantage because nobody believes them, unfortunately, and doesn't take their word as much as they would a man's word. So he already has, quote, the upper ground because of, you know, the discrimination against women. So how did she fight back, or did she fight back?
Well, that's the interesting kind of role play that went on during seances. You have this woman, Marjorie, who is refined, who is not, I mean, you know, Houdini. It's interesting what's going on, because traditionally, if you go back to antiquity, you have these confrontations between these virile male figures and witches or sorceresses. So it's a male virtue and here, you know, heroic power and force versus a woman's psychic power. And you have this again and again in antiquity. You know, as we talked about before, you have Circe versus Odysseus. In medieval times, you have King Arthur versus Morgan Le Fay. You know, Morgan Le Fay tries to steal King Arthur's sword and in that way emasculate him. So this is it's an ancient confrontation in a modern setting. You have Houdini, who wasn't just a magician. Houdini was considered the personification of American vitality. I mean, when he was younger, he had this body which was considered, you know, almost a physical wonder. And he was known for his potency and his virility. And here he's coming across this beautiful young psychic medium. And of course, you know, her power is psychic. But then you have this really interesting role play, which is going on during the seance, because it really isn't Houdini versus Marjorie. It's Houdini versus Marjorie's spirit control. And that is Walter, who is a very potent, powerful force in his own right, although his force is invisible. So in a sense, it's still, you know, a woman's psychic power versus, you know, male potency and virility. But it's played out in a seance, you know, in a place where, you know, completely dark. You know, what is all your muscular power? What use is that in a seance when you're going up against, a psychic force? So, again, it's a very interesting role play because, in a sense, it is a male versus a male, because Marjorie's in trance. She's supposedly unconscious and she's not aware of what's going on. And her spirit control is cursing at Houdini, and he's putting a curse on Houdini, and he's attacking Houdini. And, you know, he has this violent poltergeist phenomena that he's directing at Houdini. So it's just a fascinating kind of role play which is happening, because in a sense, Marjorie is channeling a virile male figure to deal with Houdini. You hit on something which is very complex psychologically, because she's trying to seduce Houdini. At the same time, her brother is sort of fighting Houdini head on in these seance conflicts. So it's very complicated what's going on. But that's basically the duality it sort of represents the duality of a lot of things in those days.
Now, we're not going to give you the final solution and what happened, because you have to get the book, but I have to ask this: what is the long-term, or was there long-term, fallout from both of these figures? Maybe some things we realize, maybe other things we don't. You look at Houdini, maybe his kind of, spiritual descendant in this regard is somebody like James Randi, who actually wrote a book on at least one, and probably, I don't know if it was multiple, but at least one book on Houdini. And in terms of Marjorie, who are her kind of spiritual successors? Is it all the psychic mediums today that say they're real, whilst people like James Randi and Michael Shermer and so forth say that they're not? I mean, has this interaction, this kind of rivalry, had any longstanding effects?
Oh, well, absolutely. Well, you know, Randi he would say he comes from that Houdini lineage. Houdini is the inspiration for all these magicians, psychic debunkers. Now, so far as Marjorie, that's a little, you know, again, because the psychics today don't really do what she did. She was a physical medium, which you don't see too many of them today that are willing to come, that are willing to demonstrate their work in a public forum. A physical medium is somebody who manifests phenomena that's quantifiable. You know, they're causing objects to move, they're making things fly around the room, they're raising tables. And of course, there are mediums who claim to do that today, but they're not willing to go before a public forum of some of the great scientists in the world and numerous reporters and demonstrate what they do. You know, the last psychic I know of who tried to demonstrate psychic phenomena in a public forum, I'm blanking on his name, but he went on the Johnny Carson show.
Uri Geller?
Yeah, exactly, Uri Geller. And, you know, Geller, they said that he could, you know, bend spoons via his psychic force. And, you know, Carson, being a former magician, you know, he knew how to deal with what he felt was a fellow magician. And he consulted with the amazing Randy, and Randy told him things like, you know, don't let him supply the forks and spoons that he's going to bend. You supply them. And, you know, he gave Carson various other instructions. So Uri Geller goes on the Carson show, you know, half of America is watching. It must have been one of the most awkward moments in television history, where the public is waiting for him to bend, you know, the silverware, and nothing happens. But he is the last psychic that I know of, and he wasn't a medium, he was a psychic. I think he's still a psychic, who was willing to go before a public forum and demonstrate physical phenomena. But remember, you know, this guy is bending forks and spoons. I mean, think what Marjorie was doing. I mean, she was making spirit cabinets, you know, implode around her. I mean, you know, she was making tables rise. So it just shows how, you know, that there's such a kind of decline in the sensationalism surrounding what she was able to do. So I would say that Marjorie really has no direct descendants in terms of, you know, famous physical mediums who are willing to go before the public and go before these forums and demonstrate what she did. What she did. I can't think of anybody today or since Marjorie, really, who's done that.
So if we want to know how the story ends, we're going to have to pick up The Witch of Lime Street, Seance, Seduction, and Houdini in the Spirit World. David, where can we do that?
Witch of Lime Street should be available at, you know, your local bookstore. Of course, you can also get it on Amazon. It's definitely out there. And it should be available just about anywhere.
Yeah, it's a major, major release. Crown Publishing, I believe. You got the big guys behind you, and I think it's going to be a smash. Very interesting stuff. The Witch of Lime Street, Seance, Seduction, and Houdini in the Spirit World. David, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Jim. It's been great talking to you.
Well, that certainly was enjoyable. We had a good time with David in our discussion of Houdini and the Witch of Lime Street. Next up is Joe Citrone, Steve Pate, and Haunted Case Files right after this on the Paranormal Podcast. Hey, everybody, a quick note. If you love The Campfire, I'm sure you're going to love my campfire books. There's 5 of them, and they can be read in any order. The newest one is Campfire 5. And if you're brand new and you want to check them all out, did you know over at Amazon, you can get all 5 books on the Kindle for the low price of $14.95? You can buy the whole 5-book series for only $14.95. I think that is a tremendous deal. If you want to take advantage of that, all you have to do is go to Amazon and type in Jim Harold's Campfire 5, the number 5 book series. That's Jim Harold's Campfire 5 book series. You can get all 5 for $14.95. Now let's say, Jim, hey, I have a bunch of your books already, but I don't have this new one. You can get the newest book for only $2.99 in the States on Amazon on the Kindle. If you don't have a Kindle, hey, if you've got a phone, they've got a ton of free apps for both Android and iPhone. So you can get the books very economically, $2.99 a piece. You can start at any point. You can start at 1. You can start at 5. You can go backward. You can buy all 5 at the same time. We aim to please. And even for those of you who are maybe low tech and just love to have something tangible, we also have a paperback version as well. I hope you'll check it out. JimHarold.com has a link on the front page to Campfire 5. You can also go over to Amazon and you can search for Jim Harold's Campfire 5 there. And now back to the Paranormal Podcast. We have 2 great guests today, and they're going to talk to us about a new television show. And they're kind of right smack dab in the middle of their season. It's on Destination America. It's called Haunted Case Files. And we have 2 folks who are right in the thick of it and are on multiple episodes. And we're so glad to have them with us. I'm talking about Joe Citrone and Steve Pate. Now, Joe has been on the programs before. He's a longtime paranormal investigator. He has had various projects and groups and so forth, and has been on various television programs. For example, he was on Paranormal Survivor, and he is also part of this new program, Haunted Case Files, which is on Destination America. And with us today, we have, I guess he's best described, I heard, as Joe's right-hand man, Steve Pate. So, gentlemen, welcome to the program today.
Hi, Jim. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, Jim.
Maybe there's some people who haven't seen the program. So kind of give us the premise of Haunted Case Files. What's it all about?
Well, Haunted Case Files is the concept, which I thought was long overdue, was taking a lot of the shows that we see where we talk about various cases and you'll see what's going on with clients and things that are happening in their home. One of the main things throughout all these years of watching these television shows is no one ever really came up with a concept to show what happens to the investigator themselves, how the cases affect them, what happens to them behind the scenes, things that they go through. I think Haunted Case Files nailed it because it takes you through the eyes of the paranormal investigator and what they go through. So it's giving a different take on one of the most key elements of any of these shows or doing investigations is, of course, we care about clients, but what about the long-term effects and the repercussions that we as investigators have to endure?
One thing I always would worry about, I'm not a paranormal investigator, I just talk to them. One thing I would worry about is things following you back and kind of spiritually latching onto you. And either or both of you can speak to this. Is that a concern, and is that a part of what it is that you do?
Well, I'll answer it, and then I'll also have Steve chime in and give his opinion. But really, I mean, one of the things that you can get caught up even doing research is you're so involved with helping a person or conducting an investigation, gathering evidence, and you're into everything. But sometimes we leave ourselves open on the spiritual aspect of what do we do as investigators before a case. What I do, you know, I can't speak for every investigator, but I like to do is I like to definitely say a prayer. I like to protect myself in the best way that I know how, and to execute with motives that are purely to help another person, not to go there and aggravate anything or try to see if spirits exist or go into areas where I don't believe investigation should be conducted. So I think you have to go into it with a lot of caution and prayer, and know that the motives that you have going into a case might reflect the outcome of the case itself.
Steve?
Yeah, well, you know the old saying, Jim, don't take your work home with you. That's how I feel. And you know, Joe summed it all up. Always at the end of a case that Joe does, he always says a prayer. There's always a cleansing and always says a prayer. And I think this is how I feel. And I think Joe will attest to this. Once he says that prayer towards the end of the case, I think it puts up that wall. I picture it as almost like a spiritual wall. I grew up a Catholic Christian my whole life. And I, you know, I always say my prayers and, yeah, that's another story. Anyways, I feel it puts up a wall, that prayer that Joe says as we walk out the door of each case, where it almost stops whatever's going on in that house or in that building, that it just stops it there and doesn't follow us home. That's the only way I can describe it, if you understand.
Sure. Now, do you guys find that different things you encounter kind of have different demeanors? In other words, are some things maybe very gentle and light and so forth, and then some things are nasty and actually maybe come after you, the investigator, because you have the nerve to check into it?
That's a great question. Jim, throughout my years of investigations, I've always gone down various paths as far as what I believe truths were and what they weren't. There was a time I remember that I believed everything could have been evil in nature or demonic in nature, as the term goes in the Christian community. And it was always one-sided. But as you start to go through your quest, you know, to find life after death. And when you do find it, okay, what is in there and what goes on? I could say that there are variables. There are times we can go into a home that it seems to be nonviolent, or you know, there's no agitation or anything like that. And most of those times you deal with a residual haunting or something that, you know, somebody had, or maybe somebody had crossed over and they're in that 72-hour state where things might happen, whether an object moves or some sort of remembrance or sign that a loved one may give you before they cross over. Then there is the negative energy aspect, the demonic, if you will, aspect, poltergeist aspect, where you do get a, we'll say, pesky spirit who will draw off the energy that's in the home, draw off of people's fear, might move objects, might do things to scare you, might touch you, might push you, might poke you, might even scratch you. So every case is different depending on the history and what is happening in that home.
Now, here's a question. You said something there, and sometimes when people really know a subject, they'll kind of mention something. And it's like, whoa, talk to me a little bit more about that. So the idea of this 72-hour period, explain to what that is, what you're talking about there.
Okay, so the 72-hour period was originally a theory, and I'm sure a lot of people had these theories throughout, you know, time as far as investigation goes, but about 10, 12 years ago, I had dealt with an investigative team, and they were very helpful in educating me on the scientific aspect investigating. And typically, when somebody has crossed over or recently died, we have noticed that there are a lot of clients that will claim that something within the period of, and we could even go as far as saying from the death to the wake to the funeral, in that 3-day period, there always seems to be some sort of sign, some sort of residual effect of the person that's crossing over. Now, for me, I did happen to see, you know, live firsthand on it. My father had passed away tragically of a heart attack back in 2005. Coincidentally, 3 days before his death, him and I had a conversation about death, a very, very strange conversation that we never even talked about. And he just asked me, you know, where do you think we go when we die? And I gave him my opinions on what I believe was happening. And we like to believe there's a heaven, and we like to believe there's a place of paradise that we go to. And we just had this deep conversation. That was our last conversation. And 3 days later, he had passed. Taking from Wednesday to Friday into Saturday morning, and Saturday morning being his funeral, he had in our house, he had a clock, a wind up clock that sat on the mantle, and that was his favorite clock. He would clean it, he would take it in for repairs if there was anything going, maintenance, anything like that. He loved this clock. So we're all sitting there, and we just got back from the funeral. We're sitting in the living room, and all of a sudden, the door, a little glass door to the clock that you can't just open really easy. I mean, you have to kind of like pull it and it just pops open.
Right.
Just opened and shut.
Hmm.
And one of the neighbors that were there, obviously, who had known him, seen it. And right off the bat, she started crying and she says, "I believe everything is going to be okay." And she explained what happened. And she said, "That, I believe, was your dad's way of saying he's okay. Mm-hmm. That's his favorite clock. Mm-hmm. Everything is fine." When I went to that group and told them what happened, that's when one of the investigators says, "Well, you know what, Joe? Usually if it's somebody who's died and they've accepted their death and they're content and they're ready to move on, we'll usually hang around until that funeral to make sure everybody's okay. Will give some sort of a sign, whether it's an object moving, something that was really valuable to them, or even appearing in a dream in that sequence before they cross over," which I found really comforting and fascinating.
Yeah,
I love that story, Joe. You told me that before.
Yeah, you hear so many of those stories of, and I want to see what you think about this, because I kind of get this from my Campfire program. And if you're not familiar, you're listening to this show. Campfire is basically a show where people come in and tell their ghost stories. We've been doing it since 2009 and have about almost 280 episodes. And the thing is that Joe and Steve, what I find sometimes is the stories or the signs from loved ones who passed, it's not this full body apparition, but they could be more subtle and they can be something that has a meaning to the person. For example, Joe, your dad knew that you would understand that clock. You know what I'm saying? So I guess my question to you, is that what you find, that sometimes it's not a full body apparition, but it is a more subtle kind of sign from above?
Jim, that is a great question, and I will be more than happy to answer. Only because of the years of being involved with investigating, I have been able to pull a lot of truths, debunk a lot of stuff, or give a lot of opinions. But I will tell you this, when you said the key word, and the key word is subtle, here's what happens. In the movies, we see full-blown body apparitions in great detail. We see big objects being moved, bureaus, beds, violent people getting tossed. Not to say that they don't happen, because on rare occasions, things do happen and they escalate like that. But the majority of signs, if you will, that happen, whether somebody has crossed over or even if they've been dead for 2, 3, 4 years, maybe even 10 years, the subtlety and the way spirits move in that realm is exactly what you said. It will be in an object. It will be something like a clock. It'll even be something like a song. It's the littlest things, a voice in the wind that you can't really hear audibly, but you know something is going on. They will bring, I believe, they bring a remembrance to you and our energy by thinking about them, crying about them, manifest. And they will give you some sort of sign. I mean, I can tell you countless stories of people who have lost loved ones, that they're thinking about them and they've been on their mind for so long. And all of a sudden, a song on the radio will appear at the exact second, at the exact time, precisely as that person needed to hear it. Now, you can say it's coincidence, or you can say that it is definitely a phenomenon. It's something that only you know when it happens, meaning, if it's something supernatural, you'll know in your heart of hearts when it happens that it's something supernatural, not done by a fluke. So subtlety, signs, and the littlest things are our loved one's way of communicating with us. It might not be the way TV or movies presented or the way we want to hear it, but if we stop, think, and listen, we can hear the supernatural almost every day in our lives.
Guests are Joe Centrone and Steve Pate. Both of them are a part this season of the new TV show called Haunted Case Files. You'll find it on Destination America. And Joe and Steve, you definitely have some interesting cases coming up, I know, as we go along here in the season. Now, this one, I know, Joe, you've done a ton of work on this and really focused on, so we'll only cover it briefly. But I know that you have the Sally House investigation coming up. Talk to us briefly, because I know this, you talk about this all the time, and we want to cover some new ground, but tell us a little bit about the Sally House.
Okay, so in short, the Sally House, which we all should know in the paranormal community right now, is a house that's set in Atchison, Kansas, and back in the early 90s, there was a family that was getting attacked by an entity in there, which were the Pickmans. After that, there has been various episodes on sightings and the Sci-Fi Channel and so on and so forth of this hot spot called the Sally House. I had done a project in 2007 called the Dark Hauntings Project, where I wanted to take a crew in there and film a 3-day investigation in there to see if there was any validity to what was happening. When I did go there, we had gotten a lot of findings, a lot of evidence. We did have multiple people pushed, attacked, things like that, that happened. The fallout after the Sally House case became more psychological, not so much physically things happening to us individually, but a lot of it was psychological. People were going through a lot of various trials and tribulations in their life as a result of it. So it was brought to my attention from another investigative team that the house will get you in two different ways. One of them would be either a physical, and the other one would be emotional and psychological, which did happen to me, and which I ultimately believe led to my son getting attacked by a spirit, which we did have that in our last episode on Haunted Case Files called Close to Home. So the episode that we will see that we did is more on my take as an individual person, not so much of the team and the whole project that we did, but just my take from what was going on psychologically and what I was seeing visually in the house.
Now, I have to ask you this because I believe that this happens, but you guys would know way better than me, and I want both of your opinions on this. I think people tend to watch some of the shows, I'm not saying the show, but some of the shows, and they kind of say, oh, that'll be cool, and that'll be fun, and let's get matching shirts and go out, and maybe not quite realize what they're getting into. Have there been cases where people have jumped into this, and then they got a whole lot more than they bargained for?
Absolutely, and I'll answer it briefly, and then I'm going to have Steve give his take on it, because he's experienced various episodes as well that's happened. What happens is TV has a way of glorifying everything that we watch. If we watch something scary, they know when to go right to a commercial and give you something funny to take your mind off of what you just saw for a few minutes. That is all the what I call the imagery of TV and media and fantasy. We know just the right timings to do things and make things a lot more appealing than it is. Investigating. When young kids see these shows, the first thing that they want to do is they want to buy themselves a camera. They want to grab a recorder, maybe an EMF detector, and they want to go into warehouses, and they want to go into cemeteries, and they want to go into all these places just to find something, because that's how they see people do it on TV. They'll laugh, they'll joke about it, and they'll be like, this is great. Let's go. So they get a team, they go in there, they start snapping pictures. They might grab an orb. They might get something that looks spiritual. But then all of a sudden, they might get a push. They might get an EVP that calls their name. They might get something that really freaks them or see some sort of image. Now their whole concept changes. Now they're almost shocked at the fact that this is real. And in my thoughts to that is, of course it's real. We've come to a point that we don't have to prove if the supernatural realm is real. We already know that. That's the no-brainer part of it. What we don't know or what we don't think of is the repercussions of seeking the dead. Is it for profit and gain? Is it for research? Is it to help somebody? Once you can come to grips with that, then your whole outlook on how you live your life is affected until the day you die.
Steve?
I couldn't have said it better myself. I just have to say this, that the Sally House case, I wasn't on it. I would have loved to have gone with Joe. But anyways, that I think this case, which is coming, is an up-and-coming episode on Haunted Case Files. It's on Destination America channel on Sunday nights at 10 p.m. We don't know exactly what week, we were talking about that earlier, what week they will show this. But people, you have to tune in to see this, what Joe went through and the crew went through at the Sally House. It is amazing. And I would say, and this is, you know, taking it right up there with a lot of these other high profile cases, but I would say this case is probably the scariest, I guess the word you could use, for lack of a better word, since the Amityville Horror House. And
wow.
Oh yeah. And Joe can tell you a lot in detail. I know that, you know, the show is really going to Haunted Case Files on Sunday nights at 10 p.m. on Destination American channel. They're going to get into it in detail. But, yeah, Joe knows more about it than I do. And you got to tune in to watch this. It's unbelievable. There's a lot of crazy stuff that happens.
Now, I know, I believe you both were on an episode called Hide and Seek. Tell us about Hide and Seek.
Hide and Seek was a case that it's really interesting. And in matter of fact, I can't even give away the ending of it, because it's the outcome of what I thought it was going to be and what it ended up being were two entirely different things. But Hide and Seek, in short, was a case that we did that was in Massachusetts, and it was dealing with a family who did have a child, and they were experiencing paranormal activity. When I finally did the case, and I didn't even look at it as a high priority case at that point in time, things with like the baby monitor and voices coming through a baby monitor, a couple little things that kind of red flagged me. I said, you know what? It's not too far of a drive. I'm going to go check it out. When I did go check it out, obviously there were a lot of different things happening, and I called it hide and seek only for the fact that there was a spirit that we were dealing with that was almost throughout the whole investigation. I seem to be playing games and doing certain things and almost having a game of hide and seek with us throughout the house as we're doing the investigation. So we're trying to do one thing. The spirit is trying to do another thing. And it's just a fascinating case and something that I'll always remember. Because when you deal with children anyway, as far as babies or people are having facing things that are happening in the house, it bothers me only because I know the still frame images of seeing something horrific as a child, how that can traumatize you throughout the years of your life, like how it happened to me as a child, being confronted by a spirit right around, I think it was the age of 7 years old. It's something that you never forget. So if I can go to these houses and help people and either debunk something and put their mind at ease or maybe offer a solution to a problem that's happening, you know, supernaturally, that gives me the most gratification knowing that I can help somebody and maybe save them years of trauma.
I tell you, Jim, that the name of the episode, Hide and Seek, it's the perfect name, as Joe was saying. I can't give away too much, but there's, you know, as you guys were talking about earlier about the senses, the five senses, most of the time, you know, it's sights where you'll see that apparition or the sounds on a tape recorder, and that has happened many times. I was going to tell a little story about actually smells through the paranormal earlier, but we moved on to a different subject.
No,
tell
us a little bit about that.
Okay, well, I just wanted to say, as far as the hide and seek, when you see this episode, there was a part where, as Joe was saying, it seemed like when Joe was, you know, in there, we were investigating, it seemed like every room that we went in, as we were leaving, the apparition or the ghost child or whatever you want to call it, was almost giving us a sign, right, Joe, of, wait a minute, I'm in here. Or if we moved into another room, I'm in here. There was always a sign. And in one of the rooms, I'm not going to give it away. You got to see the episode. But there was some movement, actual movement. We almost caught it on video camera, but there was actual movement of an object in the story that we witnessed ourselves.
Have either of you ever been on a case, and it doesn't have to be one of these cases, where your recommendation to, let's say, the family was get out. Whatever this is, you're not going to beat it. Get out. Have you ever been to that point where you've told somebody that?
Yes. One of the things that I've always learned through my research and throughout the years, I had a demonologist tell me one time many years ago that spirits feed off of fear. And I do believe that. I do believe there are cases where you will give that spirit energy to do what it needs to do by you causing it to live on, meaning your desire to know what it is, your desire to have it investigated, to give it enough attention, sometimes is just the enough amount of energy that they need to sustain themselves to stay in that particular home. What I also find out about certain people is a lot of them want somebody to speak to. A lot of us investigators spend a lot of time more doing consulting and counseling to somebody who just needs a person to hear them. Those people, I believe, long for a lot of attention. In longing for that attention and knowing that they have activity in their house, if they were to move, then that would take the attention off of them and they would just find themselves in a state where, okay, now I'm not getting this attention anymore. I know it's as crazy it sounds, and there's people out there in the paranormal community that'll probably understand what I'm saying, but half of the time when there's something going on and you can pray and you can do blessings over and over and over again and nothing happens, you have to tend to try to figure out, why is this still happening? And if it's so bad, why aren't you getting out of that house? And I think ultimately, it is that. It is probably a person's emotional state that fuels that energy for that spirit. And they somehow coexist together for years to come. Or if it's that bad, they will eventually move. But in most cases, you're not going to deal with violent entities. So there are so many homes right now that are coexisting with some sort of spirit activity. We're not talking always full body apparitions. We might be talking about residual hauntings, a couple little things, objects moving here and there. But somewhere down the line, our mental state, our emotional state is just enough energy to fuel and keep these spirits active in particular homes. Because it's not so much the homes that these spirits long to occupy. It's the emotional state of a family or a person's mind is what keeps them there.
Is it gratifying to you both that this program is looking at the investigator? I know you mentioned that before is something that you liked about the show, but what does that mean? And do you think that it's helpful to maybe people looking to do their own investigation?
I'll give you my interpretation and I'll have Steve give his interpretation on it. I think what this show has done is show the other side of the paranormal or the other side of investigating. Sometimes it is boring. We're not always going to get evidence. There's going to be many times you're going to go into a home and they're going to find nothing. And some people need that validation and that's good enough. But then there are the times that we go through things individually throughout our lives that affects us. To have a show that finally, at least in this season, and I hope there'll be another season, that is tapping into what we might be experiencing, whether it's boredom, whether it's the monotony of investigating. It's almost like being a police officer. Not every case is going to be a shootout. It's just not going to happen that way. It's going to be a lot of talking, taking notes, recording, and doing whatever you need to do. I hope that this show continues to show all the different sides of what a paranormal investigator has to go through and needs to do to sustain the longevity of doing this, because it does take a toll on you mentally and emotionally and sometimes physically, only because I believe that the energy and the electromagnetic frequencies and all the things that are happening that we can't see in the air is affecting us, almost like how a cell phone will affect us through the course of time or Bluetooth headset. I think somewhere down the line, scientifically, we will prove more and more that there are things happening to us physically, internally, than we realize by investigating.
Steve?
Yeah, and the haunted case files really solidifies the case itself. Meaning, you know, me being part of a show and Joe being part of a show, we're watching this at home after, you know, filming these episodes. And I'm looking at the reenactment saying, this is exactly what happened. It's exact, like word for word in the, you know, the scenes in the house. And I think people can really feel that from the paranormal investigator side in this show, more than just hearing the story from the people. Don't get me wrong, Jim. A lot of those other shows are awesome. I watch them all. I love them all. Anybody that has the paranormal story, I'm glued to my seat to listen because I've been there, so I know that, you know, it happens. But this, in this case, with Haunted Case Files, again, I got to say, it's on Sunday nights on Destination America Channel at 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Anyways, it's just taking it from the paranormal investigator's perspective and really putting it into detail. And I like the way they're doing this. And I hope everybody else does, too.
And Joe, I'll let you have the last word again. Where can people find the show and when can they watch it?
Okay, so they can find the show, as Steve said, on Destination America at 10 p.m. Sunday nights Eastern Standard Time on the Destination America channel into season one of Haunted Case Files. And We're almost midway through that season. Also, I would like to say this too, if you need to get in touch with us for any reason, I have opened up Dark Hauntings Research for investigations again, starting to assemble different cases and taking a different approach on how I want to do stuff now. You can go to my website, www.joecitrone.net. There you'll be able to find all information about everything, even the Paranormal Podcast, Jim, because I do have your banner up there because I think it's a great show.
Well,
I think what you're doing is awesome. So I'm plugging the paranormal community as well. But if you think you have a case, there's information where you can contact us. If you just want to give an opinion, whether you like the show, whether you don't, what would you like to see changed, everything you want to know, you can go on there and find everything all about us.
DocHaunting.com
as well.
That sounds great. And if you can spell the website for us, just so we make sure we've got it.
Okay. So it'd be www.joecitrone.net. Even if you hit .com accidentally, it'll all refer to my website there, and you'll have all information, evidence. I'm putting an evidence gallery, so you'll be able to watch a lot of different videos and pictures and listen to EVPs and just kind of surf around and find some different things out. So I'm looking forward to see what 2017 is going to bring, and we'll go from there. And hopefully, Jim, next year we'll be having another conversation about other stuff, because it's always a pleasure listening and being part of the show.
And I just want to say, we got some really good cases coming up, Jim, that Joe, people contacted Joe. We'd like to come on in the future in 2017 and share those with you. These are private cases that Joe and I will be involved in. It looks like the way Joe is explaining it to me, it looks like something really fascinating. So maybe we can come on in the future and talk about those detail.
That sounds great. Our guests today have been Joe Citrone and Steve Pate. They are part of the new TV series Haunted: Case Files on Destination America. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome, Jim. Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Jim.
Well, yet another fun paranormal podcast. I hope that you enjoyed it as much as I did. I hope that you'll tell a friend during this spooky season. A great thing to do is literally, with their permission, take their smartphone, show them how to consume the content. There's so many apps out there on the iPhone. Of course, you got the podcast app with Apple, but there's a ton of others. And on Android, you've got a ton of apps. Also you have things like Spotify and Stitcher Radio and iHeart Radio. So almost anybody can now access the shows. And I think that it's really expanding and it's getting bigger. It's a great time of the year. So please tell people about it. I would so much appreciate it, because we don't have those big marketing budgets, but we have something even better. We have you, and all of your support over the years is much appreciated. And it's really exciting to see the shows coming into their own and growing bigger and bigger. And it's all because of you listening. Yes, I'm talking to you. Thank you so much. We'll talk to you next time on the Paranormal Podcast. And as always, stay spooky. We'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye. Now for the legal disclaimer. We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold and JimHarold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although we really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to JimHarold.com, and thanks for listening.